Well, welcome to yet another wonderful Our Daily Work, Our Daily Lives. It's great that you're all here. Today, we're very happy to have Brooke Bolton with us from International Falls, Minnesota, from Rainy River Community College. But before I introduce Brooke and her topic, let me just commend to you that tomorrow night at the MSU Library at 7 p.m. is our commemoration of the 40th anniversary of the loss of the Edmund Fitzgerald with its crew of 29 off of Whitefish Point up in Lake Superior. Dean Anderson, Peter Kakala, and Michael Velbel will be on a three-person panel looking at the issue of, in Michael's case, iron ore, Peter's case, iron ore shipping, and in Dean's case, he's state archaeologist, he'll be talking about shipwreck. And so we'll be reading off the names of the crew and doing a moment of silence, so we'll just send those around. Gary can be my secretary today. Later this month, the last of our November brown bags, Heather Pristash is going to be in from Wyoming to talk about a handmade response to sweatshops, craftivism, protest and critique of consumer culture. That's coming around. And last but not least is just the rest of our season. We only have one more in December when we'll have master craftsman Tom Pearson talking about metal spinning, which is actually a craft that is a skilled trade within the auto industry, a dying trade within the auto industry, but quite an interesting one. And he uses that craft both, he's retiring now, but he used it both on the job and he also uses it to make other craft items, artistic craft items. So we'll find out all about that in December. I would commend to you the exhibit downstairs, Iron Hulls and Turbulent Waters. Please come downstairs at some point and see that. I think you'll find it of interest. And let's get on with our thing today. What many people might not know about Finns is that Finns came to the United States as one of the most literate single groups of immigrants in the history of the United States, probably the most literate group of immigrants. Over 90% of the Finnish immigrant of all classes, ruling and immigrant working class, were literate when they came to the United States. Finnish libraries were sometimes the most extensive single holdings of books in many communities in the upper Midwest. And Finns were very, very strong readers. And for that reason, Finns were the backbone of the intelligentsia within the industrial workers of the world and other social movements in terms of their writing. Today, Brooke Bolton is here from International Falls, from Rainy River Community College. She finished her PhD at Northern Michigan University, and specifically had it as her topic, what she's talking about today. She's talking about a Finnish voice for labor, Aku Paavo's poetry, and the immigrant working class. So please help me in welcoming to Our Daily Work, Our Daily Lives, Brooke Bolton.
Thank you. Since I have enough copies here, I'll pass around the poems to you, and then if others come in, you're welcome to share. There you go, you're welcome. Okay, so I thought it would be nice to, instead of waiting until the very end to look at the poems, start out with a poem and then kind of work our way through talking about Aku Paavo and his life, some of the meanings of his poems, and then do a closer reading of two of the other poems at the end. Okay, so before I read this poem, all of Aku Paavo's poems are in Finnish, so I've been working very slowly to translate them into English, which is somewhat of a process. But I think so far that I have captured the essence of what Aku Paavo is trying to say. And so this poem, Freedom, talks about a theme that will recur over and over in his writing. Freedom. Oh, great word. Word that resounds to the farthest limits, word unfettered, so beautiful, word that hastens the measure of victory, perpetually higher and without bounds. Freedom, O gallant word, word equated to life, precious word, immortal, word that breaks prison walls, word of the hero unvanquished. Freedom, listen, it echoes, tolls as a hum in the murmuring wind, waters roar on its behalf. It calls, hurries, and captivates people at once toward freedom. Freedom, does it still exhale from man under shackles? Does fear still consume the breast? Has the thought not already expanded? Or is it still chained to night? Freedom, morning light, who pushes for resolve in the chest, who dies at the call, who exchanges the golden cost of our own success, our freedom. Do you hear it? Can you hear it? Rise, winds swiftly hasten the air, rise from the chasm, go to the mountain, there, where the idea flies free, untouched by this God-forsaken country. Okay, so just keep some of those themes and that language in mind as we talk a little bit about Aku Paivio and his life. So he was born in Kärsämäki, Finland. Has kind of an interesting story. He was born out of wedlock and therefore had a couple of name changes throughout his childhood. So Aku Paivio was actually a name that he adopted. He was only educated until the age of 16. And while in Finland, he worked as a courtroom translator. He also worked as a police officer, but was doing various forms of writing. When I spoke to his son, Alan, who lives in West London, or London, Ontario, I believe, he said that they weren't quite sure to what extent his father was writing while they were in while he was in Finland, but we do know that he was writing. And because of his prolific writing while he was in Finland, he was offered a job with various newspapers in the United States. And then at the age of 26 is when he first migrated here. So he started out in Calumet, Michigan, then moved to Pittsburg, Massachusetts, then on to Thunder Bay, where he homesteaded for a while, and finally to Sudbury. Here we go. This is the only picture that is available of him online. I have heard from his son, Alan, that there are other photographs from family elsewhere in Sudbury and in Michigan, but this is the one that is accessible. So while in Ironwood and Calumet, he worked for Kansanlehti, Päivän Uutiset, American Uutiset, and then in Pittsburgh, Raivaja, where he was an editor for almost 10 years, and then worked for Vapaus and Leiki in Sudbury. And this picture is taken from the time that he was working for Vapaus, which means freedom. There's like a magic spot somewhere here. I don't know if I'm pointing it. Okay, thank you. All right, so a few of the quotations that I'm taking here are from conversations that I had with Alan, who the last time I spoke with him was a little over a year ago. So he's, I guess, 96 now. But we talked for a while and I was able to get some pretty interesting information. So Alan said that they don't really know where his father's writing talent came from, but all of Aku Paivio's, well, I guess all, at least two or three of his sons were very talented in different ways. And Alan said he inherited his talent. We don't know where it came from, but writing decided his life in a big way. So it's what motivated him. It's where his determination laid as well. So Paivio had a profound literary motivation. He was very prolific, writing hundreds of poems, plays, even an opera exists somewhere. I don't think the opera was ever published or put into action, but it does exist. And so haven't even really scraped the surface of these 200 poems, but I do have some of them. And the plays, I've come across one that he wrote for children, but that's the only one that I have seen. But money was not his motivation for writing, and none of his publications of poetry or prose supported the family in any way. It was all his editorial work for these newspapers that kept the family going, which I think already says something to the cause of his writing and what it stood for. It's not the money, it's the meaning behind it. And it's interesting that he had been writing an autobiography also amongst his other writings, but unfortunately it was destroyed in their second house fire in 1956. Also in my conversations with Alan, he referred to his father as a red fin, but not of the deepest shade of red. So we had the Red Fins, who were more of the socialist, communist reputation, and then we had the White Fins, who were more on the conservative religious side. And Paivio himself was not religious, he was an atheist. His wife, however, from the way that Alan put it, kind of gave in to the religious ideology, even if she wasn't quite in agreement with it. And Alan said that when asked about religion, Alan's sister would say that she was Lutheran, even though the family wasn't really practicing any type of religion. So people would come to the house, and Paivio had an attic where he would write. And Alan said that he never actually went up into the attic, but he would kind of go up the stairs and take peeks at his father when he was up there writing. And his mother would tell him, you know, stay out of the attic, your father is writing. But also they would have friends or people from the community come over. And they would go up to the attic where Paivio was writing, and Alan said he would hear these great arguments going on in the attic about society, politics, government. But none of that ever made it into the public sphere. He was a very private, very shy person. And from what I can see of these, what would have been considered at the time very radical views are what come through in his writing. And his writing is very clearly where his voice is. It's too bad that he wasn't more maybe vocal in public or out in society, but we can definitely tell where his virtue and his morals lie by analyzing his writing. Had it last time. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. Thanks. When talking to Alan, he referred to his father as the poet laureate of the Fins, of North American Fins. But I've taken that a step further, and I would like to call him the poet laureate of the working class, especially for the immigrant working class, not only of the early 1900s and the time that he was doing most of his writing, but I think even now, because I think the message is still very, very true to this day. And Paivio was of the belief that all writing should be aimed at the education of the working man. And like John said, we're talking about a very literate group of immigrants when we're talking about the Fins. So they were always creating new newspapers. I think at one time there was a newspaper for every 1,000 Fins, maybe in the around 1920, something like that. So they were definitely into expressing their views in writing and then also consuming those ideas by reading. So even though Paivio's poems were only reaching a Finnish audience, they were still very inspiring and motivational for that group. So of these many hundreds of poems that he has, we have commemorative poems that discuss working class movements both in the US and Canada. He wrote dedication poems for different events, working class events related to different places in North America. And then celebration poems were written when different halls were opened. Oh, I think I got it. Okay, it worked that time. Okay, so I did a side-by-side here to show kind of some of the traditional poetic themes that he uses in his writing. And then there are so many working class themes that, I mean, we could be here all day analyzing the different themes that come through. But you will definitely see in all of these poems aspects of light and dark, how those images are used, day and night. Those kind of relating, because with light and day, we have this idea of hope, rebirth, starting over, another chance, and a new opportunity. With darkness and night, we have more of this idea of death, sorrow, constraint. Everything seems more possible in the daylight. We also see sunrise and horizons related to that as well. Something being on the horizon, something attainable in the future, something that we can definitely come to at some point. And then as far as actual literary style, the way that he uses the collective voice, I think is very important, especially to working class movements or the immigrant working class, because you have people who, you know, especially, you know, working in fields like mining, you have people from all over the world and they do not speak the same language, but they find a way to communicate. And the way that they communicate is through, in my opinion, how they unite together to try to overcome these hardships of their working conditions and their struggles and the way that they are just so oppressed and kind of suffocating under the power of the government and the companies that they were working for at this time. So the fact that so far in the poems that I've looked at, he does not use the I. He is never writing from his own point of view, which I think is very important, because he was not one of the people in these jobs, but he was giving a voice to a group of people who definitely did not have a voice at this time. Repetition, and I've got a little bit English on you here with the use of conjunctions, but you'll see that in the poems he uses the word and over and over and over. And I have a few ideas for why I think that is. But repetition is very powerful. Sometimes in great speeches we'll hear a phrase repeated over and over, such as "I have a dream" from Martin Luther King, where the power of that phrase really resonates with us, and it's something that echoes in the writing, but it's also something that we attach to and that we remember because of that repetition. So I think that that's another important thing to look at. You could also analyze that the repetition relates to the idea of the workday or the lives of these workers who are living the same experience over and over and over again every day and never quite making any progress. On the right side with the working class themes, we have, of course, oppression, the idea of a physical pressure or a figurative pressure. We have images of chains, shackles, restraint, both figurative of a job or of a company or of a power, and then also physical chains or shackles or restraints. Corruption, of course, both government and from a company, again, like a mining company. Power works in both ways. He shows the power both of society or a company or of capitalism, but also the power that the masses, that the working class could have by uniting. Slavery, of course, goes with the ideas of restraint and oppression. He definitely views workers as slaves to their jobs, to the company. So that comes through quite a bit. He makes some reference to working conditions and wages, more specifically in some poems than others. And then we have the more positive scale of themes here at the bottom. Unification, the masses coming together, the idea of freedom, hope, victory, and then, of course, voice. Thank you. Okay, so we already looked at the poem Freedom. So the next poem that I would like to look at is Rise of the Masses. And then the last one will be To Justice to Humanity. If you are not familiar with the image here, this is the infamous stairwell at Italian Hall, which used to stand in Calumet, Michigan, up in the UP, in Copper Country to the west in the Keweenaw Peninsula. And in 1913, during the copper strike, there was a horrible event that happened on Christmas Eve, where a number of immigrant families were celebrating Christmas, and there was a call of fire, and somewhere between about 75 and 80 people were killed in this stairwell because the doors at the bottom were blocked, and many of those were children. And so in the last poem that I will read, there are specific lines that relate to this event. It was very, very tragic. So I like to use that image just so the audience can kind of see where some of his details are coming from. Okay, so then we'll look at Rise of the Masses. That should be your second poem. Do you see the tired worker? He faces eastward, westward. Now the world is already agitated, and the oppressed, they ascend in masses to rectify trials on the horizon. Nocturnal, they rise from their graves, clothes soot-coated and ragged. They rise from below the ground, faces paled by great suffering, but bright of eyes and ethic. They raise their calloused hands, which before they would only dare let fall. They nobly and forwardly exult, rear their heads with firm knowledge to liberate and to right the day. And the masses' fighting cry rings to the edge of the world. It's very appropriate. And it knows it will excite change, and that the force of allied masses measures the road to victory. And they see the world's power as that small, trampled fungus left behind by a child in a fairy tale who is tumbling on the mountain, so they see a great little. To crush the iron soul, to scoff the yet unfortunate, to be a victor on a bloody road, to be exploiter satisfied in horror, and to demand the sacrifice of many. But time already demands so strictly, and payday is already a measure of effort. Who you dominate will dominate you. He himself has already passed judgment. It collapses, and the oppressed triumph. Okay, so the image in this poem that was the most difficult for me to translate was the stanza on the right here about the child playing on the hill and kind of trampling over this mushroom, which when I was translating, I thought, what in the world does this have to do with the working class and these struggles, and now there's fairy tales and mushrooms, and this was something that I had not encountered in my translating process so far. But I think that image is so important because it shows that this is the way that people see the power. They don't even give it a second glance. They're just gonna roll right over it and keep going. So I think that really speaks to his abilities as a poet, but also in being able to create this great metaphor that is very kind of culturally specific to Finland or Russia, where mushroom picking is a great pastime and something that the Finns, I think, would appreciate seeing in a poem. So looking at the poem Rise of the Masses, we see this idea of rising. There's battle cries, ideas, things that reach out, resound, echo, reverberate. We saw that in Freedom as well, where we see this word that he's celebrating. He devotes a whole poem just to the word freedom, and he equates the term freedom to life. Without freedom, life is just slavery. So we have this idea of freedom, and when you think of this idea as we go through the poems here, think of it as something that people are almost afraid to talk about or approach. And it's this cry of freedom, of coming to freedom, that he is trying to express, and using different methods of carrying that idea along. So think of it as a metaphor for reaching out to a wide group of people by way of the wind, or by calling, or by crying. We could also interpret this, if you're familiar with the industrial workers of the world, the call for the workers of the world to unite, which we saw on the socialist emblem in the image earlier as well. So this call also represents the collective voice, both in call and response, calling out to the workers, but also expecting them to respond, because we need them to unite in order for their efforts to be successful. Okay, so with freedom, we have the wind rising from the chasm, freedom being the first poem, if you want to have all of them out in front of you. But we have the wind rising from the chasm, the depths of the earth, reaching out to the mountain, which we see as the pinnacle of challenge, but also as success. So being able to overcome that, this call for freedom reaching just as far. Okay, so we take that concept of rising, transfer it to the poem I just read, The Rise of the Masses. So looking at how the workers rise from their graves, they're working in grave-like conditions. If we think of the miners deep down in these dark shafts, and how many deaths occurred in these mines as well, they were almost like living graves. I mean, even if that itself is a contradiction, it's the truth. So I kind of interpreted this as kind of a symbol of the miners and the struggles that they dealt with on the job every day. So we know that they worked long days, they were in constant darkness. So any time that we see this image, as I said, of light or day breaking, we think of that new hope, or of being able to break out of that darkness, break away from the monotony of those jobs. And we see that both in freedom, where he refers to freedom as morning light, that new hope, and then also in Rise of the Masses, when we have these nocturnal workers coming from the depths of the dark and then into the light. Okay. If you look at the third stanza on Rise of the Masses, there is a reference to the idea of knowledge and liberation. Rear their heads with firm knowledge to liberate and to right the day. I interpret this as a direct nod to Paivio's belief that the purpose of writing was to educate the working class, and that this education and this knowledge is what, and awareness, is what was going to bring the workers together and raise them out of the poor conditions and the poor situations that they were in. So referencing the idea of power or knowledge, when the masses are aware that they have the knowledge to achieve liberation, that they are more self-aware and are brought to that, and I feel like being part of a union often had this effect on people, which is why, of course, the companies did not want them to unionize, because now they're communicating and they're getting dangerous ideas of how can we change things, how can we break away from this. So I think that definitely comes through here, and the importance of education, not only in the institutional sense, but education in knowing yourself, knowing your value and worth as a human, and never letting anyone change your mind about that or take that away from you. So before we move on to the next poem, I just want to say that there are so many images of power and corruption and struggle that I have not pointed out all of them, and we won't go through all of them, but I think that they are very, very clear. So let's turn to the third poem. I just realized that you don't have copies of these. All right, so this one's a bit longer. So it's to justice, to humanity. It is definitely, for me, the most emotionally moving of the poems and the most effective. As I said, it was written in response to the copper strike of 1913 in the Keweenaw Peninsula. And there are specific references to some of the murders that took place during that time, the use of thugs, the distrust between Workers' Federation of Miners, the WFM, which was a union, and the Citizens Alliance, which was the group that was, I believe, ultimately blamed for the Italian Hall tragedy, but was never proven, but that was the consensus of the families who were involved in the tragedy. And of course, he does make mention to specifically the children who were trampled in this terrible incident. Okay, so let's take a read of this one and then we'll talk about it a little bit more. To justice, to humanity. Now behold, humanity around the country. Justice has already gone from the world. All that remains is a bloody wrong, wretched roguery and filth. Humanity has succumbed completely. Its heart has ceased to beat, and the beast has risen. Its strength and lust have seized control already. Step away from your high statue, you, goddess of liberty, your country and glory shamed to the sea, your torch smeared with blood. Your country is Russia's equal, New Siberia, field of horrors, and it rises to compete with brutality, this, your glorious continent of freedom. Here, it is not safe for man who demands his human rights. Assassins track traces of him, and criminals write laws unto themselves. Here, it is not safe in homes. Hired murderers hem them in. Butchers pierce their sides with bullets, yet, if lucky, death will evade them. Here, it is not safe even for children. As victims, 100 are trampled. Assassins are hiding everywhere, and out of sight, the culprit smiles. Now thugs and wretches, imported to terrify the people, to reproach and murder them, are granted with guns and the right to kill. This is everything to abhor in humans. This is everything that is elsewhere disdain. Here, now, most impotent justice, and government does not impose its bolt. Here lives insanity, cold cruelty, the world's soul of material wealth. And will these innocent victims be enough to satisfy the throat of the beast? Is justice gone? Has all humanity collapsed? Are the bondage of slavery and the squalor of misery getting harder? No, justice has not succumbed. It lives still on the other side. It will rise, a frontal threat, and it does not intend to die. And humanity has not yet collapsed. It still hopes and trusts as one suffering, threatening eternity with wait for the day that it will rise. It hopes that no bloody weapon would need to be lifted. It trusts that without victim, there will be no need for revenge. But how can it be, if forced by what you would not grant? The whole world can feel the strike, and the hurt resounds so deep. Enlightenment has cried, slaves of the earth, from your bondage, rise up. Away with oppression, away with misery, and to the world, humanity's right to power. And the slave is heard and sworn to. We declare justice will prevail. And the day of freedom, if not yet come, will certainly dawn. Okay, so we see Paivio cycling through the collapse and the demise of humanity and justice, and he escalates fear and threat on a national level. So he takes the specific event that happens in the UP and expands it to a national crisis. He unveils the beast that is capitalism. He exposes the facade of liberty he doesn't care if he's insulting the United States, which is, you know, famed for its freedom. We can see the Statue of Liberty in the beginning of the poem, her torch smeared with blood, country and glory shame to the sea. We have this goddess of liberty, you know, watching over us, and here's Akupaibio saying, where is this freedom? Where is this liberty? You know, we have your huddled masses yearning to be free up here in the UP of Michigan, and that's not what's being stood for here. He also equates the U.S. at this time, the issues with the working class, with the workers, to Russia, which I'm not very familiar with what was going on in the history, in Russia's history at this time, but I know that the situation between Finland and Russia was one that Finland was about to receive independence from Russia, which happened in 1917. So the situation there was not great. So we have this other idea of independence back home in Finland. Okay. In addition, he denotes in a harshly honest light the ill state of the working class and the corruption of.
So I'm definitely open to taking questions, or if you have any questions about any of the poems, or.
Well, let us thank Brooke for the presentation, and then let me start with the last poem. Just because the fact that an alternative way of looking at that title is directional rather than as an ode title. So if it's actually to justice, to humanity, that is directional, which I think would be plausible rather than necessarily that it is an ode per se, like to a Grecian urn or other examples like that. So does that make sense as a possible rereading of that?
When I was first translating this, that's how I interpreted it, the way that you just said it. And then as I started thinking about it, I was like, maybe this is the right way to translate it. Maybe I analyze this as a quote, mm-hmm. because it's so different than what we would think of as a line of appreciation.
Okay, and I've got other questions, but perhaps others do as well. Questions or comments? Dorothy?
Yes, I was interested in this part on fungi. The most brilliant student I've ever had was head parents from Finland, and she's approximately 70 years old now. She's a member of the National Academy of Science. I know her. Personality quite well, you know, because I met her as a freshman and realized she was brilliant. You know, but she didn't realize it, or she didn't want everybody to know it. So I think your analysis of fungi related to the poetry and so on is fascinating. She was at Tulane in New Orleans when the hurricane hit. What did she do? She went out and analyzed the fungi growing in then later in New York area, New Jersey, when the hurricane hit back, she went out and analyzed the fungi in that area. And then, you know, I tuned in her public radio here one day, and she was being analyzed for her studies of the fungi in different places. But, you know, obviously a very different personality.
Right.
And it's interesting to know, to think about whether this is peculiar to a particular national group that emigrated here, this sort of drive, because freshman year it was obvious to me that she knew more about fungi than I did. It was quick. So anyway, that's just a comment.
Well, I had a student years ago, and she was from Russia. She wrote a whole essay on her childhood taking mushrooms and mushroom soup and mushrooms and that. So,
well, this woman has carried on to the molecular level.
Well, while we've got mushrooms going, let's go there a little further. I guess that the one image that, and Dorothy, you're the biologist, so correct me if I'm wrong, but I think we've often thought of mushrooms as nocturnal, too. That is, you know, they grow in the dark or whatever. So the degree to which, if you're using dark and light metaphor, and if the mushrooms can either be one of two things, that is, I mean, at least I'm looking at that, if they see the world's power as that small trampled fungus left behind, so, you know, perhaps, you know, forces of emergent light trampling a creature of the night in the form of the mushroom kind of thing. Well, did I get that right? I mean, they do grow in the dark. They don't require light. And they're often found in mines and in other kinds of places for that reason. So, right. So that's an interesting kind of thing. The next, that one stanza, To Crush the Iron Soul, do we know what year was Rise of the Masses written?
What
I was, I have copies from the books, and I don't have the copyright date of the books written down with me. Well, I'm thinking that it's an Iron Heel kind of reference to Jack London, and I mean it would make sense to me that Pavo is actually playing out the Jack London thing. And the other thing is, you're absolutely right on Finnish history. That is that. Since the Grand Duchy of Finland was a part of, you know, either, unfortunately, my native Swedes on the one side or the Russians on the other, dominated the life of Finland until after World War II, for the most part. But I think that it's interesting that he's invoking Siberia and, in effect, I think, really trying to tell America that, you know, you pride yourself on being a democracy, but you're acting as if you are also a monarchy, just like the Russians are at that point. And so I think that Siberia, I think, and generally is invoked a lot in that period, I think, in literary circles, in terms of people being aware of, naturally we become far more aware of it in the Stalinist period, but I think people are aware of it in the last days of Nicholas as well, as kind of a place of exile and everything else.
Barren, you know, being kind of this barren place that you were sent to, but, you know. Yeah, people think of it the Stalinist era, but I mean, certainly during imperialist era was also used as a place where you are sent to and then probably are coming back.
Well, and the fact that Siberia, unfortunately, is not unlike northern Michigan and northern Minnesota the same resource base, trees, minerals, snow, ice, you know, I mean, it. So there is a certain consonance, I think, that very well may be there. Other comments that people have or questions about Pavo? Help us understand one thing, I guess, to put you on the spot. That is that the publications that he worked for, if I remember rightly, if you would go back to those, and my Finnish is awful, as I think that Gary would tell you. But there we go. But wasn't Rivia? In Fitchburg, actually, a worker, I mean, that was a pro-union newspaper. So help us understand what you were talking about, him making his money off of editorial work rather than writing work. That is, so if he's actually editing these and taking a salary, that is that he's probably putting them to bed as publications, getting all of the stuff lined up, giving it to the print guys, and away we roll, right? So, I mean, in that way, he would be working out his politics through his editorial stance as an editor as well as a writer, right?
Right, and that's kind of the next step in this process, is I have not seen any of, physically seen any of the newspapers or translated
Okay.
His editorials. I've only been working on the poems, but as I was going through some of my notes, I thought, you know, I've got to figure were workers in your magazines.
And right.
And he never edited Columbia's State, which I thought was strange.
I don't think so. A lot of times the editorial board was just as large as the as anything else. They had several editors, so it would maybe even be difficult unless they signed their name to
know exactly what to do.
But I mean, if he's actually a paid staff person, that's a different kind of editorial responsibility than editorial board per se.
Yeah.
That is because he would actually be putting the paper to bed, right? I mean, is that the way that he actually made his living?
I am only going on what his son told me, and was that the money for the family came from the editorial work and not from the sales.
So then the assumption has to be, to at least a degree, that many of those unsigned editorials coming out of some of those worker papers are actually his. I mean, I would assume, by logical extension.
I know that the Liegi, which means blank in Finnish, he had a small creative writing column in that paper as well.
Mm-hmm. But for the most part, all of these are left-of-center publications, right? For the most part? Except that American isn't, right?
No, Kansen, Paimen, and American, which is that, they're all kind of middle
range. So he was in the middle range writing still working class related poetry, but then moves to organizations that very well may be much more left of center by comparison.
Most definitely, because he became an organ for the Communist Party.
Yeah.
Yeah, because he used to, Alan said that the Canadian, I guess, forces or military would come to their house and check him out because he was, I guess, on the Communist radar.
Yeah. And what year did he move to Canada, do we know?
I think it was 1912, right after.
Right after Calumet. Right after the, well, was he there for the, was he, but he wasn't in Calumet during the time of the copper strike then. So he was aware of it, but he wasn't there. Okay, other questions on Paavo or on Finnish poetry generally? John?
Rather interesting that you mentioned an opera. Is that music and opera, or just
the opera? I'm sorry.
The opera. You mentioned an opera.
Oh,
an
opera.
Is that music and opera?
I think that he also has the music for it.
So it could be performed.
Yes. Yeah. Absolutely.
If someone showed interest.
Yeah. It's either in Gaylord, Michigan, or in Sudbury, because one of the family. This is his. Who's maybe great nieces and nephews and maybe a granddaughter to have all of his work in a box somewhere. So the opera is there. I would not be able to write the music or performance, but I mean, finding someone who could definitely.
Do we know what the opera is about at all? That would be fascinating to find out.
Yeah, because he has, actually it was,
Well, and for those of you who might not have caught the Hall celebration of halls is the celebration of the launching of specific Finn halls, I assume. And Finn Hall Theater was a fairly large thing, as Timo Ripa and others have written about. So it very well may be that he was writing plays that very well could have been actually produced in Finn Halls across the upper Midwest at one point or another. It's fascinating stuff.
The one that I looked at when I was down in Minneapolis was, they only had one in their archives there, and it was written for children. It was something about geese. It's all I remember.
Well, remember that Finnish stuff written for children doesn't come without an edge either, though. However, so these are the worker children who should rise up against their parents and demand more ice cream, you know. Other comments or questions for Brooke about the work? Well, fascinating stuff. Thank you so much for coming. Let's give her another round of applause. For those of you who are interested in things UP, do come Tuesday night to the library for our commemoration of the Edmund Fitzgerald. And we look forward to seeing you at other Our Daily Work, Our Daily Lives events. So thanks for coming.